you're with us for the morning show as we explore the world of vaccine development. I'm Kate Archer-Ken. Thanks for being here. A COVID-19 vaccine would teach our immune systems, right, to recognize, to fend off the virus before an infection could take hold. And a vaccine would allow us to get back to our world of work and not sheltering in place to resume normal life. But developing a safe, effective vaccine typically takes years, if not decades. And right now, everything is on the table. At least 180 clinical trials are moving forward. Dozens of vaccine candidates are in exploratory stages. What do you want to know about this path to developing a vaccine? We're at 800-642-1234. Mary Haney is a professor in the UW-Madison School of Pharmacy, and her lab, it studies responses to vaccines, particularly in immunosuppressed patients. Mary, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Oh, thank you, and thanks for having me.
How difficult is this mountain to climb, so to speak? How difficult is it to develop a vaccine for a brand new pathogen?
You know, we've not really done, well, let's see, we've done it multiple times. However, the time frame in this case, the expected time frame is incredibly short, and that would be a whole new game if we could conquer this one. It typically takes years to develop a vaccine. There have been vaccines that have taken over 10 years to develop. They have to be extensively tested, and both for safety and for effectiveness.
So in this process of really contracting here and making it go so much faster, how are they able to do that? How do you move a vaccine development at a hyper speed?
Well, one thing is that we now can use genetic technology. You know, of course, when, you know, Edward Jenner made the smallpox vaccine or the vaccine for smallpox, they didn't even really know about the immune system. So the technology keeps improving. And because we so quickly knew the genetic makeup of SARS-CoV, which is the virus that causes COVID-19, scientists could very quickly use that genetic information to start developing the vaccine. And in fact, some of the vaccines that are furthest along in the investigation process are genetic vaccines, vaccines that use the genetic material of the virus, or from the virus, that would be a better word to put it, as the vaccine itself.
And so that gives you kind of this, a little bit of a something to build from, a platform to build mm-hmm. from, to know exactly what you're dealing with?
Exactly, because traditional vaccine manufacturing requires that you grow the pathogen in the lab. And then oftentimes it'll be grown, there's many different types of vaccines. And so let me start by going through the different types of vaccines, because in fact, all of the different types of vaccines are candidates for the coronavirus vaccine. So, for example, and this is a really good way to use it to vaccinate people, is to grow the virus in the lab, and then as you grow it, the virus becomes weakened, and eventually it becomes weakened so that it doesn't cause disease. Mm. And it can be used as a vaccine because it'll still elicit an immune response when administered to the person, even though it will no longer cause disease. And that's called a weakened virus or a live attenuated vaccine. Those have been used. We use those for, say, measles mm-hmm. and varicella, the vaccine for chickenpox. We also use inactivated vaccines, which are vaccines where you just grow the virus in the lab, or the pathogen. It could be bacterial as well. But you grow it in the lab, and then you inactivate it, somehow kill it. And the virus remains in its shape, so the immune system can't differentiate and will still make an immune response to it. Another type of vaccine is a viral vector vaccine, which is really some cool technology that where you use one virus, insert the gene of interest for, say, in this case, it would be the coronavirus vaccine, into that virus, and the immune system will make an immune response to both of them.
Oh, wow. So, change the makeup of the gene.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that's a vector vaccine. It is it's the technique that was used for the recently licensed Ebola vaccine.
And how effective is that type of technology? Because that's certainly using modern technology to tackle a problem.
Well, it was very effective for the Ebola vaccine. Let's see, I'm not sure I'm going to be able to quote the statistics exactly, but that vaccine worked very well in clinical trials, and so was recently licensed.
We're talking with. Go ahead.
Oh no, that's okay. I used to say, and hopefully we won't have to use it here in the U.S.
Mary Haney is a professor with the UW-Madison School of Pharmacy, where she researches vaccination, other protective effects. We're taking your questions about how you create a vaccine. We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Mary, let's look at what's on the table here, starting with the Pfizer last week. We've been hearing about a possible vaccine like mRNA, and it's a shot, mm-hmm. and they're developing mm-hmm. hundreds of millions of doses. What do we know there?
Well, this is a vaccine technology that has not been used before in humans. So it's a new vaccine technology, but has great potential. It's been, it's been thought of and considered and tested, but we just haven't used it yet for a successful vaccine. So what you do is you use the RNA, which you'll remember from your biology classes, can be translated into a protein.
Mm-hmm.
So the protein is a virus protein. And then your immune system makes an immune response to that viral protein that is made by your cell. So the vaccine itself could be very effective and is so cheap and easy to produce. And that is going to be a key issue for the coronavirus vaccine, as essentially we need to vaccinate the world.
So many pharmaceuticals in this race as well to find something that works. Moderna has been in the news moving forward mm-hmm. on its version of mm-hmm. mRNA 1273. What do we know about that?
That actually is a similar technology to the... to the Pfizer one. They're both mRNA vaccines.
So as these companies throw all of their research, all of their everything at coming up with a vaccine, I'm wondering what happens to, what does that mean for producing existing medicines that come out of these pharmaceuticals? Do we have any concerns there that we won't be able to get the things that we've always gotten from the Pfizers of the world?
Those systems are well in place, and barring any other type of outbreak, those should continue to be produced. However, we know even from treating coronavirus that maybe some of the treatments, current medications that are being repurposed for treating coronavirus have come in short supply. But those are for different reasons. But say medications that we use for treating hypertension or high blood pressure, those we should generally be okay with those.
We have UW-Madison Pharmacy Professor Mary Haney as our guide to vaccine development. What do you want to know about how vaccines work? Would you volunteer for a coronavirus vaccine trial? What have you learned about how pharmaceutical companies and governments are working to develop a vaccine? Join in through the hour. We're at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in a minute with Mary Haney right here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're looking at vaccine development and the pandemic. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Physicians have been trying lots of existing drugs on the shelf, malaria medications, anti-influenza pills, Ebola treatments, but so far, no clear breakthrough. Researchers are testing hundreds of potential candidates in search for a cure, and that will take time. Do you work in a lab or vaccine research setting? What aspect of this problem are you working on? How are you collaborating with colleagues around the globe? What will we learn from this moment? Be part of this at 800-642-1234. We have Mary Haney with us. She's a UW-Madison professor of pharmacy, and she's our guide to vaccinations. Let's take a call now. Stephen is joining us from Eau Claire. Hi, Stephen.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I just wanted to pass along a unique experience that I had. When I was in college back in the 70s, I heard a speaker who was one of the guys who was on the original team that developed vaccines. And one of the things that he said was that when they were originally developed, they used an attenuated virus, and they put it in a syringe, and they raised a bubble just under the skin using 1/10 of a cc to allow the immune system to recognize the attenuated virus, but they didn't put the virus in the body. And what he said was the way they're given now, a full cc intramuscularly, they're introduced in the body in a way that they're not normally introduced, which causes reactions in some people. And my experience over the years is that there's no question some people react to vaccines because of the way they're given and the stuff that's in there that's introduced into the body. And some people don't. But if they gave them the way they're originally designed, it would be a lot safer, was his message.
Yeah, Stephen, thank you for bringing that to the table. In the 70s, Mary, what have you seen with how vaccines are introduced to the body?
Vaccines are being, that's part of the early studies. And what is currently going on with many of the clinical trials going on is that the vaccine manufacturers or the developers, I don't, not so far the furthest ones are actually manufacturers, but they, excuse me, the vaccine manufacturers and the scientists are studying the right, trying to figure out what the right dose is and what's the best way to administer it. So those are all part of the early trials for vaccines. And so, yeah, to give it by the right route is critical. So most vaccines are given by injection. There are also vaccines that are given orally. An example is the polio vaccine that adults got. The polio vaccine was given orally. You probably maybe have heard, you know, that they would squirt it on a sugar cube when it was first given in the early 60s. And now it's in a little tube. We don't use that vaccine anymore, but it is still being used in the polio eradication efforts. It's a great vaccine. It is put us where we are with near global eradication of polio. There's another oral vaccine that's rotavirus. It's a diarrheal illness that is typically most severe in infants. And the use of that vaccine has dramatically changed diarrheal illness hospitalizations in infants. And then there's a nasal vaccine. One of the influenza vaccines is a nasal vaccine that's squirted up the nose, which is exactly where the influenza virus would enter. So you have a first line. This vaccine develops that first line of defense right there.
So there are different entry points to be able to mm-hmm. administer vaccines, and that, too, has evolved over the decades. Mary, you know, as you look at the biological difficulties, the chemical difficulties of finding a COVID-19 vaccine, what are the challenges of creating one when the whole world is trying to suppress this outbreak and get rid of it and trying not, you know, to root out the virus at every turn?
That actually helps. There's going to still be plenty of people who need a vaccine. The coronavirus is very contagious. However, let's face it, the vast majority of people have not yet been exposed. So that will be the group of people who need the vaccine in order for us to have a society where the outbreak is no longer a threat.
We're talking with Mary Haney, a professor at the UW-Madison School of Pharmacy, where she studies vaccines, taking your questions about how they're developed and what the timeline is for them. Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Mary, the World Health Organization has said this development of a vaccine is going to take immense cooperation between governments of the world, between academia and research institutions, between the pharmaceutical companies and the private sector. What is this type of relationship like, and how do you coordinate something like this between all these different sectors?
Oh, yeah, that is a huge question. And there's already papers being written about this, like how should we do this? And nobody has a great answer. But even for the development part, it's a big partnership among government, industry, and academic research. The government is funding much of the vaccine development. And then it's a partnership between maybe your academic research lab who has a particular vaccine candidate, and industry has the capacity to produce it. And the federal government will help fund some of the studies. And so those three need to make a partnership and move their vaccine candidate forward through clinical studies that will satisfy the FDA's standards for safety and efficacy.
But when there's intellectual property involved, can that get pretty tricky between companies and within governments?
Generally, and I can't speak for every company, but generally the intellectual property still will belong to the company, or you work it out. It's a negotiation that's done in advance.
What are you seeing out of UW-Madison? Because there's the CoroFlu, which is being developed by an international collaboration, and it's it has some potential here as we look at COVID-19. What are you seeing?
Oh, yeah, that's a very interesting strategy that the FluGen, as well as a vaccine company in India, have been working on. And it's a vaccine that will be delivered nasally, and it was specifically designed for to prevent influenza. But they've been able to add a coronavirus protein on it that will indeed induce an immune response. So essentially, that could be a vaccine for both coronavirus and influenza. So it would protect against two respiratory infections with a single dose. Or I shouldn't, I don't know how many doses it'll take, but with a single product.
Right. Where are they in this research phase? What is the status?
As I understand it, they are in preclinical trials, which means they are still testing it in the laboratory, but hope to get ready to go to trying it out in humans in late summer.
All right. We'll be watching for that. Let's bring in Mark now in Madison with a question. Hi, Mark.
Why? I have two questions. One, is there any existing coronavirus vaccine? There may have been some in development, but is there any produced and used in large populations? The other question is about dengue fever. People can get dengue and largely recover from the first infection very well, but with subsequent infections of dengue, the same virus and strain, they become very, very seriously ill. Is there a possibility this sort of pattern could happen with COVID-19?
Thank you, Mark, for those questions. Mary, go ahead.
Okay. To answer the first question, no, there is no coronavirus vaccine that is being used in the population. Yes, there was some work done on coronavirus vaccines with the SARS outbreak in the early 2000s, and then more recently the MERS, both of which were more self-limited coronavirus outbreaks. But there is nothing ready to go. And so we can use the technology and what we learned from the starts of developments of those, but we'll build on that. The question about dengue, we coronavirus circulates in the population anyway. It's one of the causes of the common cold. This just happens to be a novel one that causes much more severe disease. My crystal ball doesn't work that well, but it is, I think, unlikely that it will act like dengue, but and cause a more severe infection when you get another type. But it will probably develop some level of population immunity to stop the outbreak. And then maybe coronavirus might, this virus could continue to circulate in the population. But because we have some low-level immunity, and that we don't know if even the immunity, either we don't even know if infection protects you from future infection.
A lot to learn. We have UW-Madison School of Pharmacy Professor Mary Haney helping us understand the infrastructure developing, administering a coronavirus vaccine with your questions at 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're inside the world of vaccine development. And in the face of this global health crisis, scientists and pharmaceutical companies and regulators, everyone's sprinting to test hundreds of vaccine candidates. But without clinical trial data, it's really impossible to predict which contenders will actually emerge from all the experiments that are underway. What can we learn at this moment about the hunt for a vaccine? And this is a way off, but medical ethics here. Who do you think should be the first to get the coronavirus vaccine? Join in at 800-642-1234. Mary Haney is a professor of pharmacy at UW-Madison. She's an expert on vaccines and the immunization of immunosuppressed people, and she stays with us. Let's take another call now. Mark is here from La Crosse. Hi, Mark.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, from what I'm hearing, it sounds like it takes years to develop an effective vaccine. Should we be suspicious of any shortcut vaccines that come out quickly? And then with Secretary Mnuchin saying that if we don't end the lockdown soon, there'll be permanent damage to the economy. It sounds like an effective vaccine probably won't be part of that strategy to open up the economy.
Mark, thanks for the question. Shortcut vaccines, Mary. If we get one out there really quickly, will it be compromised?
I am confident that that there will be no safety and efficacy shortcuts taken. It's a full court press. Ordinarily, vaccines don't receive the funding these vaccines are in clinical trials. We have an urgent need, so. The vaccine manufacturers and researchers are working carefully with the FDA to assure that these vaccines are meeting the safety and effectiveness standards that are required. So I don't think we should be suspicious. We need to carefully examine all the data, and it'll undergo peer review by many experts. So I don't think we're going to have a vaccine in a couple of months. And I think that we may even have multiple outbreaks of coronavirus as we reopen and mix and some social distancing. We may have another outbreak and we may need to retreat. I think a vaccine is ultimately the long-term answer to this, but I don't think that anybody will be taking any shortcuts in the vaccine safety and efficacy to roll one out quickly.
Mark, thanks. Let's bring in Ron now in Madison with a question. Hi, Ron.
12 to 18 months is outrageously overly optimistic. A recent vaccine took 25 years to develop. The Dallas Morning News says 10 to 20 years. Two recent examples, pneumonia, a bacterial vaccine. The first one out supposedly stopped 13 strains. but isn't terribly effective. And then more recently, a different company claims theirs will stop 23 different strains, and it supposedly is better. I read more details on the shingles disease caused by the smallpox virus. The first one out was only about half effective, and the company for the selling the second one claims around 90%. Think about the pandemic misnamed Spanish influenza.
Well, Ron, I want to pause right there, Ron. Mary Haney, I mean, Ron brings up shingles and pneumonia and how well these vaccines actually work. What is that threshold for success?
Well, it depends on it depends on the disease. It is a very disease-specific threshold for success. The example that he brings up of the shingles, the first shingles vaccine, was only 50% effective against shingles itself. But if you did total burden of disease, including some of the pain syndromes that come after outbreak of shingles from the chickenpox virus, it was about 67% effective. And in an era when there's nothing better, that seemed to me that would be a gamble I would take. It was safe. I recommended that my parents get that vaccine. And and now that we have a better vaccine because technology moves forward, the new vaccine, is about 90% effective against shingles itself. So not just whole burden of disease. And again, I want my parents to get that vaccine. So, we are able to make better vaccines as we learn more things.
As we learn more things, and mm-hmm. Given that time in the lab, that time of development and understanding what you're dealing with allows you to, make a better medication, a better vaccination. Let's go to Patrick now in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Patrick.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning.
Say, I understand there's people get antibiotics when they have, bad bacteria in their body, and there's also probiotics, for instance, in the gut. Is there a version like a pro-virus or good viruses that are beneficial to humans?
There's becoming increasing recognition that viruses are part of the microbiome, which are the commensal bacteria that live with humans. And so there are. This is getting outside of really what I know a lot about, though.
Well, Patrick, thank you so much for the call. We're talking with Mary Haney, a professor at the UW-Madison School of Pharmacy, where she studies vaccine responses in immunosuppressed patient groups. Taking your questions about vaccines at 800-642-1234. Vicky emailed us this morning and asked how labs around the world are cooperating. Mary, we touched a little bit on this. Vicky says we need a cooperative effort to tackle the pandemic. And Vicky wants to know, are people sharing information?
Yeah, they are. And it's so interesting, some of the international collaborations that are present. And in fact, these international collaborations were present before COVID-19. Scientists love to work with other people. Yes, we're all a little competitive, but we also know that we do more together. So there are partnerships already existing. For example, the reason that we have vaccines already in clinical trials is because when the SARS-CoV virus was first identified in China, the Chinese scientists sequenced it and determined its genetic makeup and made it available to the world. So that's just one example international collaboration. Many gene sequences are put on in a database that are shared widely, and then scientists very quickly publish their research findings to see how, so that we can share our data and share our findings with other scientists. Typically, those experiments that we publish, the journal articles we publish, are peer reviewed by other scientists who are independent of the project, and will provide comments to improve, or even say, hey, this is not worthy of publication. It's not good science. So that happens routinely.
Let's take another call. Bob in Shawano is with us. Hi, Bob.
Hi there. Say, my question has to do with the politics of vaccines. If the English, for example, if their vaccine is approved and it seems to be effective, how much does the fact that it's not a U.S. Company that's doing it, that is we could adapt that particular vaccine?
So does it make an impact if the company is located outside the U.S. or the research is located outside the U.S., Mary?
Yes, it does. That's a great observation. What happens, though, is that this vaccine can also be studied at the same time in the U.S. And depending on how the manufacturer is working with the FDA. So even if it's a manufacturer outside the U.S., they could still work with the FDA, because the FDA has ultimate say over whether or not a vaccine gets licensed in the United States. So hopefully, if their product looks like it would be that it's going to be a good candidate, hopefully the FDA will be working with them to get that product and make it available in the U.S. as well.
I've been looking at some of the numbers on the cost of this. The U.S. government investing about $480 million to scale up production of the Moderna vaccine, Johnson & Johnson getting a pretty similar allocation. How much does it cost to create a vaccine?
Yeah, that's more than usual. I'm not going to be able to quote exact numbers. I have them on a slide in my laptop, but it's in the tens of millions of dollars typically to do a vaccine. But now we're trying to do it much more quickly, which will probably take more money.
We have Mary Haney with us for the hour. She's a professor in the School of Pharmacy at UW-Madison, where her lab studies responses to vaccines, particularly in immunosuppressed people. What have you heard about a potential COVID-19 vaccine that you want clarity on? Are you concerned about your child staying on a vaccination schedule during the pandemic? Still time for your questions about vaccines and how we get them. We're at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a moment with Mary Haney right here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The World Health Organization lists 8 candidate COVID-19 vaccines currently in human clinical trials, and 100 more candidates are undergoing preclinical evaluation in labs around the globe. So what questions do you have about the timetable for finding a cure? And will a vaccine be the cure? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. We have Mary Haney here. She's a pharmacy professor at UW-Madison, where her lab studies vaccines, and she's our guide. Let's take another call now. Ray is with us from Mauston. Hi, Ray.
Good morning to you, Kate.
Morning.
I got to tell you, though, I love your show. You always have interesting topics. But my question is that there is no, as far as I have heard, there's no vaccine for any coronavirus. And if that's true, why do they believe they're actually going to find one for this one?
Ray, thank you for that question. Mary, is this an elusive hunt? Will we get there?
Excuse me. Yes, I think we will get there. One of the reasons that there's no vaccine for coronavirus at this time is that that we've never had this pressing need for a coronavirus vaccine. Coronavirus that have been circulating outside those two outbreaks of SARS and MERS, and which were limited, these coronavirus that causes typically like a cold, the common cold. And so there's limited need. There has been in the past just limited need for that vaccine. Other diseases were a higher priority for vaccine development. Now this one completely, because of the impact of and disease burden, this completely surpasses and becomes our highest need vaccine. So I think we can get a vaccine that will mount a good immune response to it that will be safe and effective. One things we don't know is how much will this virus change, and will it be like influenza where we have to reformulate the vaccine every year? These are unknowns, but things that we can address when we get there.
Yeah, and because when we reformulate each year, some years it seems like the vaccine works well, other years not the case.
Mm-hmm. For influenza.
For influenza, yes.
Yeah, yes. And the influenza virus is so smart. It is able to change itself so that it can cause infection in humans over and over again and circulate around the world. So, and your immune response to the last version of influenza you saw is only partial protective or very little protective, sometimes little protective against the current virus. So the influenza vaccine needs work. It's at this time clearly the best thing we have. So certainly I recommend that everybody get it. I hope we will learn something even from this vaccine development push that will help us with making better influenza vaccines too.
Ray, thanks for the call. Let's bring in Jess now, joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Jess.
Hi, good morning. How y'all doing?
Doing well. What is your question?
Well, there's such a thing as natural herd immunity, where social distancing actually hurts us, because if we contract it, if most of us get it, most of us will survive, and most of us will develop the antibodies in our bodies naturally for our own immune systems. To wait on a vaccine may or may not be the miracle thing we're waiting for. We can get over this in a natural way. Social distancing has literally prolonged this thing. And by the way, when I served in the Navy, I had nuclear, biological, and chemical warfare training. And wearing a paper mask, if one, you have a beard, or two, it's not rated for a bio or chemical agent, does nothing if it's a paper mask or a cotton mask.
Jess,
literally
thank you.
Does nothing.
Yeah, Jess, thank you for the call. Mary, what is the impact of herd immunity along this continuum of finding a vaccine?
Mm-hmm. Oh, herd immunity is what we're looking for, because herd immunity will allow us to go back to normal and will prevent the widespread disease outbreaks. In the absence of herd immunity, right now we're doing social distancing. And should we, let's see, had we not done social distancing, my crystal ball doesn't work that well. We could have overrun the healthcare system. By social distancing, yes, we spread out and prolonged the circulation of disease in the community, but it prevented a big peak of disease that would have overrun the healthcare system. And we wouldn't have had the capacity to care for all of the sick people. We would have run out of ventilators, for example, and we wouldn't have had enough intensive care unit space for all of the patients. So it would have caused more, probably significantly more mortality if we didn't use social distancing. And what we need is community immunity or herd immunity. I like herd immunity, but maybe that's because this is Wisconsin. herd, meaning the human population. If there's sufficient immunity in the population, even the few susceptible people won't get disease because they have enough immune people around them to protect them from disease. And by protecting them, they can, because the immune people around them cannot get the infection, it protects the few susceptible people in the population. Mm-hmm. And we're at that point for, say, measles. In populations that have high levels of immunization, there's no measles outbreaks. But if measles comes to a population or let's say a community where immunization rates are really low, a measles outbreak can happen, and you'll see cases of measles in a population where the immunity is low.
And low, you know, that would be dropping under, what was it, like 90-some%?
Yeah, for measles, it's you know, probably in the low 90s.
Low 90s,
it's,
yeah.
Disease, but it's disease specific.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The amount of immunity you have to have in the community is specific for every disease because it all depends on characteristics of the disease itself.
Selena emailed us and would like to know more about what testing a vaccine in people would look like and who would be held accountable for poor results or side effects.
Okay. The vaccine clinical trials are carefully prescripted and decided in advance when a vaccine candidate is ready. It is tested to start with in just a few people. So if the results weren't good, you would just stop there. The phase one trials, which is where you use just a few healthy people, are to determine the dose, and maybe is there a need for boosters and other characteristics of things. And then you scale up to a phase two trial, which again is usually a few people, but it's a few more than the phase one. And so it's really very stepped so that it would, hopefully there would be no widespread damage to humans from a vaccine because it's very carefully prescripted and chosen, and people are chosen to participate in the studies who meet specific criteria. Oftentimes they have to be healthy or, non-pregnant. Those types of things are all part of the planning for the clinical trial.
And quickly here, once a vaccine mm-hmm. has been developed and we're down the road, how does it get mm-hmm. distributed and administered? What are the protocols?
Yeah, that's a great question, because how will we choose who gets it first? And again, that's part of the vaccine development and part of the outbreak surveillance that's going on. Who needs to be the highest priority to get vaccine? Might be healthcare workers. It might be the elderly because they seem to have a higher risk of severe disease. But that will all come with studying the disease and how the disease outbreak develops over time to determine who's going to get the vaccine first. Then we also need to consider global vaccine coverage and getting vaccine to low and middle income countries.
Mary, thank you for joining us.
Mm-hmm.
Mary Haney, a professor with the UW-Madison School of Pharmacy, been talking about the race to find a vaccine for the coronavirus. And if you missed any part of the conversation, stream it later today, wpr.org/mornings. Just ahead, we look at the role of philanthropy in a pandemic. That's On Point coming up next. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.